Now, my text this morning is in Exodus. And I get the chapter right this morning, chapter 33. Chapter 33. And verse 15. And he said unto him, If thy presence go not with me, carry us not up hence. If thy presence go not with me, carry us not up hence. Now, we're looking at the case for revival scripturally. We did it 2 years ago, if you remember. The last few Sundays, we've been doing it again. And this morning, I'm taking you to some lessons that we can learn from the experience of Moses in the Old Testament. Now, revival is a time when God draws near to his church. We can call it those times of extras, when he allows a very special blessing to the church. It's a time when many are added, and I quoted from one person that's spoken to me who experienced the last revival and said that more was done in one day than many years without God, without God in this special way. And it really does revive the church. The church itself is revived. Multitudes to come to the church. There are many who are excited by a revival, and shortly afterwards they drop off. You get that in everything, but the heart of the thing, nevertheless, is true. The vast majority that were blessed in the last revival in Wales, the vast majority were true and stood faithful to the end. There were just a small number that seemed to be excitable about it, but never really got hold of the truth. That happens always, kind of an excitability among some. But the real thing was lasting and permanent. Now then, when it happens, the scene is totally transformed. The Sabbath worship is transformed. We may be doing the same things, and yet there is a buoyancy, an uplift in our hearts. And although there is confessing of sin, and although there is the dealings of God with a person, which can be painful on times too, although that will be there, the end result of it is joy. And joy on a dimension that we cannot imagine. It is only excelled by the joy of heaven itself. We hear of revivals in other countries. There have been revivals in the last, say, 20 years, 15 years, in the northern part of Scotland, in the Hebrides. There have been also in places like Romania and countries round about there. There have been in Africa, in South America. There have been revivals. But we haven't known one. It's outside living memory, mostly, really, as far as you and I are concerned. And a little hymn came to my mind when I was preparing. When on others thou art smiling, do not pass us by. And sometimes in our desperation, we try to make a revival. And I think people, when they try and make a revival, they are sincere. That they're trying to make something that will stir the people. They might even announce it as a revival meeting. And I'm sure it's quite a pleasant meeting, quite a good meeting, but it's not revival. You cannot force the hand of God. You cannot compel God. God will come in his time and in his way. And you might say, well, where shall we begin? It's very difficult because, take amongst us here now as a congregation, I mean, I don't know, I know with many of you that you express a desire for revival, but I'm sure that if we wrote down on a piece of paper exactly how we felt, without putting our names to it, not meaning the anonymous in the unpleasant sense, but in the just kind of private sense, that we might say, well, it isn't that I don't want revival, but I'm afraid. Many would fear it, and we fear it because we've heard of little bits and pieces of how people are dealt with, and we think, does God expose me like that before everyone? No, it won't be like that. Even though you or I may be dealt with, and they will be confessing, you needn't be afraid of exposure. God doesn't humiliate. He humbles people. And always remember this, God never humiliates And that's a very important thing to remember. And even in a time of confession, and you might see that here are hundreds of people coming forward and here confessing, everybody hearing, not at all, because there would be so much noise that, and so many bringing their hearts to God, either silently or loudly, that the private things of one person would not be known to another. And in any case, I believe that God would cover it. So I believe it is an ungrounded fear, but many people fear that. There is a caution too. There is a caution because as a people in Wales and in England as well, we are afraid of excitability. We are afraid of something that might be all just froth and nothing behind it. And there was an element of that in revival as well. But the true thing itself was a very, very moving thing. But there is caution and we are afraid. And those things are there. May I put it to you like this? I go through that too. Of course I do. We all do. But I come to this place that whatever comes from God is bound to be good. That's right, isn't it? Whatever comes from God is bound to be good. And so what we must be really, we must have hearts that are ready and that are willing and looking for him. A heart where he is welcome. In your heart and in mine as well. Now then, how do you win a church? It's very difficult. I don't suppose ever it'll come before revival that you'll ever win a total church. I don't think. We might aim for that, but we know we're not going to do it. We're not going to achieve that. Because look at the depth of one personality and how one person can argue for and against a thing. We cannot. You can only present faithfully as a servant of God and allow the Spirit of God to touch whom he will and with what degree of power that he desires a number of people. Whether that will be a total church or not, I don't know. But he can bring enough. He can bring enough. It will creep into the prayer meeting. More and more frequently, there will be the desire that God should intervene in the ghastly situation that we're in today, in the evangelical confusion, in the religious decline, in the moral declension, in the total lack of integrity, in the helplessness of government. All this, in such an age as this, that God might intervene and that he might come amongst his people and do a great thing. You might say, well, God is all right. We're so used to thinking of little minorities and the majorities are the vast crowds in football, the vast crowds in the army, and the vast resources of a government. And here's a tiny church of people don't care what I say from the pulpit. Of course they don't. It won't be in the Western Mail tomorrow, not even a local paper like that, let alone, say, one of the bigger papers. No, it doesn't matter. We don't count in the eyes of the world. And yet, if we believe that this tiny little planet Earth is just like an orange of a thing in the scheme of things, and that God is a creator, maker, upholder of all things, and is also aware of every particle of dust that is on this Earth, as well as every corner of galaxies and universes that ever can be under its creation, then what is any passing little government and its power? You see what I mean? So that really, that we are in line with something far, far greater, far more powerful, far more explosive than any hydrogen bomb or anything that men can make. Believe it. If you really believe, how deeply do you believe in God? Is it a tiny little God who just entertains a little small group of people? Or is it a God so great, so vast, so wonderful? He's beyond our ideas, really. And we're given enough words. And all the words that we are given, like his sovereignty and his almightiness and so on, they are but fringe words. Each one of those words regarding the description of God is only a word on the fringe. The rest is incomprehensible to us. When we talk about his power, we say he is almighty, and we think we've understood. That is only a fringe word. Almighty means something far greater than we can ever envisage. We're only tiny little creatures. That is a God. And we're asking this God to enter into the situation that we're in because we are his people. Now then, Moses. Moses knew God as his Savior, and he'd gone up the mount, and he was speaking to God. And when he's speaking to God face to face here, don't mistake it, he cannot see the face of God. It is there used as a figure of speech, as a man speaks face to face with a friend. And the Lord said unto Moses, now this is in chapter 32, verse 7. And the Lord said unto Moses, go get thee down, for my people which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. And the wrath of God is towards the people. So see how quickly they turn away. I've only got to call the minister, the servant of the Lord, to the mount here for holy conversation. And the thing that I'm going to give him now. And yet see how they go away. But Moses pleads. Moses pleads with God in this part that we're looking at now. And he says in verse 13 of chapter 32, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. See, Moses is pleading, but he has no idea how bad they really are. God can see, but he's quite used to them being bad. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, thy servants to whom thou swearest by thine own self, and said unto them, I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven. And all this land that I have spoken of will I give unto your seed, and they shall inherit it forever. And God shows mercy. Now that's wonderful. You see, but Moses hadn't yet seen. And as he comes down with Joshua, as he comes down with this young man, and the young man says, I hear the sound as if it was the sound of war. And Moses said, I'm afraid it's not the sound of war or anything like that. And as they come nearer, they see that the people are naked and they're dancing and they're having a form of religion, which men always seem to like, as something that is external, as something that is excitable, something that uses the body, something that uses trinkets and things and a materialistic attitude towards God. It doesn't matter that it's a golden calf. There's a golden calf in every age that clings near to the real faith. So he comes down and he is very distressed. And it came to pass, as soon as he came nigh into the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing, and Moses' anger waxed hot. He cast the tables out of his hands, the Ten Commandments, and brake them beneath the mount. Now he has to know one thing. Like every minister has to know, really, when we really have dealings with God. See in verse, I think it's verse, let me see now, verse 26. Then Moses said in the gates of the camp and said, who is on the Lord's side? Let him come unto me. So you can see the seriousness of the situation. These wretched people who knew the way of Jehovah, they wanted to worship in this kind of carnal way. The same problem with the Corinthian church. Carnality came in there. And so Moses is distressed. He pleaded that God might have mercy upon him, but he hadn't seen how bad it was. When he came down, he was very, very angry himself. So angry that he got hold of these Ten Commandments he had and he just smashed them on the floor. Now, indeed, we might think that had he seen how bad they were, that he might not have pleaded so much as he pleaded with them. But he had pleaded and God had heard. So now we have an account of the pursuit of God. We look at the promise of God. And we go now into chapter 33. We've got as a background thought, remember Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. That's from the previous pleading of Moses for the people. Remember who we are. Remember we are the Lord's people. Offer us. Remember that we are in the evangelical tradition. Remember that we are the people who believe in the Bible. Remember that we are blood-bought Christians. That is really the argument. Remember who we are. And the Lord said unto Moses, depart and go up hence, thou and the people which thou hast brought up out of the land of Egypt, into the land which I swear unto Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, saying unto thy seed will I give it. Now that's the promise, so we have it basically there in chapter 33. And he goes on, and I will send an angel before thee into this land. Now that seems, you see, if that's very good, They've made a mess of things. They've been very bad and wicked. They've been forgiven. They seem to have tidied things up again. And the promise is restored. And he tells them that they will go into the promised land. And he says to them, and I will send an angel to guide you there. They seem to have got off very lightly, without a great deal of trouble. And the land itself, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, for I will not go up in the midst of thee, for thou art a stiff-necked people, lest I consume thee in the way. So, the one half of that verse says, in verse 3, I will send thee into the land flowing with milk and honey, the angel will lead thee there, but I better not come, says God. Because if I came with thee, it's still in my mind the golden calf and the carnal worship. So if I came with thee, thou would be consumed as a people. You'd be consumed. So I better not come. So I'll send my angel and I'll keep my promise and you can have the land of milk and honey. You can have that. But I won't come, be dangerous if I came, because my holiness will consume you. And in verse 4, the people heard these evil tidings. You must strange. You might say, well, it doesn't really matter. So long as we get a nice kind of religion and a lovely place to be, it doesn't really matter if God himself is there. So long as we have somebody representing God, that's all right. Oh, no. They knew better, you see. Like we know better. Deep in our hearts, we know better. And when the people heard these evil tidings, they mourned, and no man did put on his ornament. They said, this is a terrible thing. What is blessing without God? What is pouring our hearts without God? What is singing a hymn without God? What is the preaching of a sermon without God? What is living a godly life without God? What is the meaning of it? It is an empty shell of a thing. And so they were very, very sorrowful. They had the promise of the land, but not of his presence, other than his anger. Then at Mount Horeb, they got rid of all their ornaments. And Moses had a tabernacle, a tent built. This is a tent for heart searching. Now, this is revival talk. Those of you who are older here will know that it is revival talk. A tent for heart searching. And Moses took the tabernacle and pitched it without the camp, afar off from the camp, and called it the tabernacle of the congregation. This is verse 7. And it came to pass that everyone which sought the Lord went out unto the tabernacle of the congregation which was without the camp. So far we've had this. We've had in the previous chapter, who is on the Lord's side? Is there anybody with me who is interested in true religion? It's got that far. Then here he's saying, well, I'm asking you now, here I've got this tabernacle, this tent. You can see that the Lord is allowing his promise to continue, but he's not going to give us himself in blessing, which I desperately desire. So now let's get right to God. Get rid of your ornaments. So they get rid of all those things that's distracted. And this phrase, those which sought the Lord. Not everybody. But those which sought the Lord. Those people. And they came into the tent. And this was noticed about the tent. And looked after Moses until he was gone into the tabernacle. And he was having holy audience with God. Verse 9. And it came to pass as Moses entered into the tabernacle, the cloudy pillar descended and stood in the door of the tabernacle. And the Lord talked with Moses, and the Lord spake unto Moses face to face. That is, not speaking of his actual face, in a conversation, in a relationship, which is person to person. Now, what has been achieved there thus far is this, that he is dissatisfied, as they thought. Well, he's giving us the promised land. He's not destroyed the people as they deserve, but he is holding back himself. And Moses is saying, well, that's not just good enough for me. I'm not going to live my life and die like that. I'm not going to have it like that. So first, who is on the Lord's side? Secondly, let me see, who will seek the Lord? Here's a tent now, get right with God. And we know how to get right with God. Every one of us here knows how to get right with God. Every Christian who's born again now, washed in the blood, knows that when we have things in our hearts that ought not to be there, you can share it with a friend, but that is all right. But ultimately, you have to bring it to God and get right with God. Those who sought the Lord, those who are in earnest, you always find it. It seems to precede a revival. I may be speaking to many hearts here this morning. I trust so. The second point is the presence of God. Moses knew exactly what he wanted. So, in verse 13, now therefore I pray thee, if I have found grace in thy sight, show me now thy way that I may know thee, that I might find grace in thy sight, and consider this nation. Consider thy people. Thy people. If I found grace in thy sight. And the Lord responds. And he said, my presence shall go with thee. Verse 14. And I will give thee rest. Moses brings the argument. Now look. These are thy people. Is it enough to send an angel? Have I found grace in thy sight? Dost thou know my name? Are we in a relationship? Am I known to thee? Art thou known to me? Are we on name relationships? Is that there? Have I found grace in thy sight? He's arguing in a godly way with God. And he says, God says to him, very well, my presence will go with thee. And that's a wonderful thing. You might say, surely that Moses is satisfied here. When there are times, it can be, even outside of revival, that you can have a meeting, not so much where a person has done a lot of things in order to get people's feelings roused, but for no reason at all, even before the first hymn is sung, that you feel that there is a presence of God. And you know that he is there. And that your soul is stilled in the presence of God. I used to describe those times like this. The only person that I used to ask things like this used to be Dr. Lloyd-Jones. And I asked him, what are those times sometimes when you're preaching? Those times when the silence is so terrible, as if people were not breathing, and as if eternity had hurled itself into time. And he said, those times outside of revival are the times when the Spirit is brooding heavily over the people and speaking to many. It can last a second, it can last 5 minutes, it can last a sermon. And then he can go for no apparent reason. The Spirit bloweth where it listeth. Just like that. You must understand it and not be afraid when it comes. The presence of God in special ways. There is always a presence of God when two or three are gathered in his name. But this is something more that we're asking for, a matter of degree. But nevertheless, it is there, the presence of God. Moses wanted more, lastly, than the power of God. And he said, in verse 18, and he said, I beseech thee, show me thy glory. That's a daring thing to ask. What's he asking for? He's asking for the power of God, the presence of God now, in a dynamic way, not in a way, as I've just said, that we all or many will feel the presence of God as we sung that hymn, as we prayed that prayer, as we preached that sermon, as we listened, or as we were in silence, or during communion, whatever it was. Was there not a presence of God? And we say, yes, there was. It was wonderful even to have something of a knowledge of the presence of God over and above the promise of when two or three are gathered together. I want thy glory. I want in my lifetime to know something more than those wonderful interludes of the presence of God. Beseech thee, show me thy glory. In verse 19, and he said, I will make all my goodness pass before thee, and I will cause the name of the Lord will be gracious, and to whom I will be gracious, I will be gracious, and to whom I will show mercy, I will show mercy. I will allow my goodness and my name, I will allow that in that way to pass before thee. What language is this? It's a degree, and yet it is something perhaps out of our experience of people have known. And I've just written out here a number I'll read you one now to explain what I mean. I'll read this one. There's a famous minister in Wales years ago called, Welsh people would know the name immediately, Thomas Charles of Bala. And it was during the Bala revival, there were lots of smaller revivals, in 1791. In his diary for December the 7th, 1971. It's lovely to be precise like that, isn't it? This glorious work began on a Sunday afternoon in the chapel, where I preached twice that day, and cannot say that there was anything particular in the ministry of that day, more than what I had often experienced among our dear people here. But towards the close of the evening service, the Spirit of God seemed to work in a very powerful manner on the minds of great numbers present, who never before appeared to seek the Lord's face. But now there was a general and a loud crying, "What must I do to be saved? And God be merciful to me, a sinner." And about 9 or 10 o'clock at night, there was nothing to be heard from one end of the town to the other but the cries and groans of people in distress of soul. And the very same night, a spirit of deep conviction and serious concern fell upon the whole congregations in this neighborhood when calling upon the name of the Lord. In the course of the following week, we had nothing but prayer meetings, and general concern about eternal things swallowed up all other concerns, and a spirit of conviction spread so rapidly that there was hardly a young person in the neighborhood but began to inquire, "What will become of me?" The work has continued to go on ever since, with unabated power and glory spreading from one town to another around this part of our country. Now, there were services that were good and ordinary, morning and afternoon. Then in the evening service, he came. Let me try again. In verse 20, "And he said, Thou canst not see my face, for there shall no man see me and live." That's the real sense of the face of God. "And the Lord said, Behold, there is a place by me, and thou shalt stand upon a rock." And this is the lovely paragraph that we are familiar with. "And it shall come to pass, while my glory passeth by, that I will put thee in the cleft of the rock, and will cover thee with my hand, and will pass by, and I will take mine hand away, and thou shalt see my back part, but my face shall not be seen. But the goodness of God shall pass by, and my name, and I will be aware of the presence of God to a tremendous degree." This is what we have understanding here. So now we are in the dimension of people that write things in diaries like this. And they are so abundant and such varied people, different characters, and from different countries, that we cannot dismiss their experience and the long-lasting nature of the blessing that they had. Now, the power of God is manifest. It cannot be manufactured. I cannot manufacture it. It cannot be claimed. I cannot claim it. It either is or is not. Whatever people may claim in Britain today, in England, Scotland, Wales, the countries of Britain, any of them, there is no revival at present. Yes, there are times of churches having a gentle visitation of God. There's such a thing as that. But there is no revival, and there hasn't been a revival for a very long time. The last known revival for England or Wales is 1904. And there is none other since then. Scotland have had quite a number, but not England and Wales. Cannot be manufactured. God must be in it. Our hearts must long. What shall we do? We prepare our lives. We set our faces. We had last week. We set our faces. We have a welcome heart in our lives. We become persistent in prayer. It takes a greater and a greater place. And so that we come to a place that we are not satisfied with the evangelical norm. Put it to you like this. Would you or I be satisfied with just a handful of churches where there seems to be any degree of blessing in our age? I'm not. Would you or I be satisfied if just South Glamorgan had all its churches full for the next decade or two? And you might say, well, God says, well, I will send an angel and allow you a degree of blessing in that area. I'm not satisfied. We want more than that. We want God to intervene. We want God to come upon us and come upon the nations, and that there might be a great move towards God. That's what we're asking for. It may start in many places at the same time. It may start in one place. It doesn't matter so long as he comes. Now then, I'll finish with just these two. Or one, see how we go. Yes. Now this is written again by Thomas Charles. An entry in his diary for January 20th, 1773. I went to hear, now, Thomas Charles of Bala went to hear Daniel Rowlands. Heard of Daniel Rowlands, the great preacher in the revival, the one that started in 1735, and when something like ten thousand at least people used to come and hear him preach on Sunday in the heart of Cardiganshire, in Llangeithor. January 20, 1773, I went to hear Mr. Rowland preach at New Chapel. His text was Hebrews 4:15, a day much to be remembered by me as long as I live. Ever since the happy day I have lived in the new heaven and a new earth. The change a blind man who receives his sight experiences does not exceed the change I at that time experienced in my mind. Then I was first convinced of the sin of unbelief, or entertaining narrow, contracted and hard thoughts of the Almighty. I had such a view of Christ as our high priest, of his love, compassion, power and all sufficiency, as filled my soul with astonishment, with joy unspeakable and full of glory. My mind was overwhelmed and overpowered with amazement. The truths exhibited to my view appeared too wonderfully gracious to be believed. I could not believe for very joy. The glorious scenes then opened to my eyes will abundantly satisfy my soul millions of years hence in the contemplation of them. I had some idea of gospel truths before floating in my head, but they never powerfully and with divine energy penetrated my heart till now. The effect of this sermon remained upon my mind above half a year, during which time I was generally in a comfortable and heavenly frame. Often walking in the fields, I looked up to heaven with joy and called that my home, at the same time ardently longing for the appearance of the glorious Saviour to take me forever to himself. And then just this one, brief one, but very remarkable one. This is written by the first principal of the Theological College in Aberystwyth. And it's from his diary. He was preaching at the funeral of David Morgan. David Morgan was the great revivalist of 1859. A very wonderful revival. And he was preaching at his funeral. And at his funeral, he, in his sermon, said this. He was referring to a time when he first met David Morgan, when he came in his rounds preaching to Bala during that revival. I was in college at the time studying great matter, but never having realized them in my experience as living truth. I knew Butler's arguments for a future state and Paley's evidence of Christianity. I felt their force as arguments, but there came two plain men from Cardiganshire, that's from Spytherstwyth in Cardiganshire, to Bala, and preached Jesus Christ simply and unaffectedly, without much culture or eloquence, but they had more. Eternity pervaded the service. Heaven came down. The chapel was full of eternity, full of the presence of God. It was a dreadful place. No one needed Butler's arguments or Paley's evidences. The change that I experienced was ample evidence to me of the divinity of Christianity. Before, listen, I was a mass of damnation. Before, I was a mass of damnation. And in this service, I became a new creature. That was his evidence. And so you can get these quotations from their diaries and from their writings. Different people of different abilities. A farmer last week, a theologian this week, and a preacher. And what do they evidence? The presence of God. Indisputable when he is there. There's no manufacturing it, but there is an asking and there is a pleading and there is a desire, let us set our affections and set our sights on great things. Lord, show us thy glory. Let us pray. Our gracious and our heavenly Father, we thank thee that we can come to thee and ask now thy blessing upon us, that thy grace might ever be towards us, for thy name's sake. Amen.